From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, another deadly blast in Nigeria, attacks against the Red Cross in Guinea risking the spread of Ebola, UN chief warning Yemen on the brink of collapse, plus a U.S. TV scandal, and how it affects the psychology of false memory. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Witnesses in northeastern Nigeria say at least 7 people were killed Thursday. It happened in an apparent suicide bombing in the town of Biu. Local media quotes witnesses as saying a female on a bus may have set off the blast. This was the latest in a string of deadly attacks that have rocked Nigeria in the run-up to national elections. The election was originally scheduled for this Saturday, but postponed until March 28th because of the Boko Haram insurgency in the northeast. Youth ministers from the Commonwealth of Nations, the former British Commonwealth, have ended a meeting in Cameroon on how to prevent young people from being tempted to join terrorist organizations. The ministers agree that 2 of the biggest factors are massive unemployment and the failure to involve young people in decision-making processes. Moki Edwin Kinzika is in Yaoundé with our report.
The Deputy Secretary General of the Commonwealth, Deodat Maharaj, says Africa is the world's most youthful continent, with 65% of the population below the age of 35. 10 to 15 million people enter the African labor market each year. Maharaj says this is potentially dangerous for a continent that is poor and facing challenges of war, disease and terrorism.
People don't have jobs, they don't have livelihoods, they don't have education, they don't have services where they live, they may do other things. What we want to do is to provide the best possible technical perspective and analysis for a government to decide, based on national ownership, which option is the preferred option.
African youth leaders, including Namibian-born Katjitguru Polin, says the greatest problem with Africa is that youths who constitute a majority of the population are often not listened to before policies are drafted.
One of the biggest things that is going to suppress the voice of the African youth is that there is no consultation between youth and seniors. And how do you unite people from different backgrounds, people from different cultures, people with different perspectives? You engage and you consult. Don't speculate. Don't come up with things that you think is going to benefit the African youth.
Jean-Marc Afesimbafo of Cameroon's National Youth Council says young people in Africa continue to face daunting challenges because educational systems do not give them the opportunity to develop their full potential.
We have to reform our educational system to equip the youth with the skills necessary, not to wait for jobs, but also to be able to create jobs for themselves. And so we have to move from that educational system, which is essentially based on education, when we just took over our independence, and we need to form administrators, we need to form civil servants to nurture this young nation.
Afesimbafo adds that young people have a hard time obtaining loans from financial institutions. Zambian Minister of Youth and Sports, David Musonda, says terrorism, especially the Boko Haram insurgency in Nigeria, is partly driven by chronic pervasive unemployment.
That does not give the young people the mandate to go into illegal activities. Government is concerned, the Commonwealth is concerned, the world is concerned about the youth. We have relatively a huge young population across Africa. And these are very productive, they have the energy, and to go and begin to join terrorist groups does not provide a solution to the employment challenges that we have.
The youth ministers said they can defuse the unemployment time bomb by working with the private sector and government to create safe, decent, and competitive employment opportunities. They said they will encourage multinational companies investing in Africa to use African labor. They also reiterated calls on African countries to invest in agriculture. That sector employed 70% of African youths before 1985, but doesn't attract young people today due to lack of government support. Moki Edwin Kinzika, VOA News, Yaoundé.
Red Cross has condemned attacks against its volunteers in Guinea, warning the risk spreading of the Ebola virus. Medical aid group says two volunteers were seriously beaten this week in Western Guinea. Lisa Schein has more from Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
Attacks against Red Cross workers in Guinea are not new. There has been an average of 10 attacks per month since last March, soon after the Ebola outbreak in that country began. But this latest incident was particularly serious and scary. The Red Cross team leader for Ebola coordination and support in Geneva, Beerta Hald, has just returned from West Africa. She tells VOA the Red Cross volunteers were attacked by an angry mob while trying to provide a safe and dignified burial in the community. Hald says there is still a lot of misunderstanding about how Ebola is spread. She says some believe that volunteers spread the virus while disinfecting houses with chlorine.
All of a sudden, it runs like a bushfire where people start shouting that the Red Cross is carrying the Ebola, and then they start attacking, either verbally abusing or even throwing stones or attacking with whatever they have at hand. And we've had a few cases where cars were burned, and we've had a few Red Cross volunteers taken to hospital.
Hull says volunteers from time to time have been unable to access communities. She says this is very dangerous because people who treat ill patients or conduct burial ceremonies without any protective gear are at risk of dying from Ebola and of spreading the disease. In its latest situation report, the World Health Organization reports nearly 23,000 confirmed cases of Ebola and 9,162 deaths in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. It says cases remain widespread in Sierra Leone but have stabilized, while Liberia continues to report a low number of new cases. However, the WHO says there's been a sharp increase of new Ebola cases in Guinea, with 65 newly confirmed compared with 39 the previous week. It says the spike has been driven mainly by transmission in the capital, Conakry, and in the western prefecture of Forakaria, where Sunday's attack occurred. Hall says she is concerned the epidemic is not under control and could flare up again.
Another concern is also that very soon the next rainy season will start, and two things is that it'll make the roads impassable for prolonged periods of time. And secondly, we also know that the virus thrives in the humid conditions.
Hald says the Red Cross is beefing up security for its volunteers. She says aid workers also are consulting more closely with communities, local authorities, and religious leaders to try to dispel myths and false rumors about the disease. She says the agency's worst fear is Ebola will become a permanent disease in West Africa if it is not brought under control. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
UN Secretary General warns that Yemen is on the brink of collapse as peace talks there have faltered. Houthi rebels dissolved parliament and announced that they will be establishing a new presidential council after the resignation and house arrest of President Abed Rabah Mansour Hadi. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the UN in New York.
Ban Ki-moon recently returned from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, where he says his meetings focused on the crisis in Yemen. On Thursday, the United Nations chief said Yemen's neighbors are very concerned the situation will deteriorate without the international community sending a strong signal that the country's transition must not be undermined. Mr. Bon warned that Yemen faces political, security, and humanitarian challenges.
Let me be clear. Yemen is collapsing before our eyes. We cannot stand by and watch.
The worsening security conditions prompted the United States, Britain, and France to close their Yemen embassies. Mr. Bond said the focus must be on helping Yemen quickly reestablish a legitimate government authority. For the past 3 years, his special envoy, Jamal Ben Omar, has been helping guide Yemen through its political transition. Thursday, Ben Omar told the council via a video link from Sana'a that the country has a crucial choice before it.
Today, Yemen is at a crossroad. Either the country would descend into civil war and disintegration, or the country would find a way to put the transition back on track.
He warned that the instability is creating conditions conducive to the reemergence of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. While in the south, where former President Hadi is from, many people are expressing secessionist desires. Ben Omar said the country could fall into an economic crisis if no political deal is reached soon, as the possibility of the local currency collapsing is real. The UN plans to ask for nearly $750 million for humanitarian needs this year, as more than 60% of the population requires assistance. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
For some perspective on the U.S., Britain, and France closing its embassies in Yemen, VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with visiting Middle East professor Nabil Khoury at Northwestern University.
What you have now is simply a recognition by Western embassies that they no longer have state with which to deal. They no longer have anyone that can guarantee the security of their diplomats. And given the deteriorating security situation in Yemen, they can effectively not do their diplomatic work anymore.
The Houthis insist they're not linked to Iran. Is that true?
No, that is not. They are definitely linked to Iran. The only question is how deep that relationship goes. We've known for some time that they have been encouraged by Iran, have received funding from Iran. They've also received training and advice from Lebanese Hezbollah. All Yemenis know that.
What does this do for the U.S. effort against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula?
That, unfortunately, remains the major preoccupation of the U.S. I fault this with contributing to the deterioration of the country because we were so preoccupied with following al-Qaeda that we didn't pay attention to the internal politics and the deterioration, and we did very little diplomatically to help keep the country together. I think the chaos which is resulting from Houthis fighting other tribes and fighting southerners will be good for al-Qaeda.
There are reports Saudi Arabia is arming Sunni tribes in the south of Yemen. Are we headed to a civil war?
It's not necessarily going towards a full-scale civil war. It may be going towards a secession, though. The Saudis have armed Sunni tribes before. They're going to help the southerners probably secede, partly because they can then have part of Yemen that owes allegiance to them and can work with them. At the end of the day, it's really not up to the Saudis or anybody else. It's up to the Yemenis. They will either try to work something out and stay together as a country, or they will break apart with all the chaos and fighting that that entails.
Given the turmoil in Syria, Iraq, and Libya, Professor Khoury says the region is in a long period of instability, with the balance of power tilting toward Iran. Also in the news, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is praising the efforts of key world leaders to end the pro-Russia uprising in eastern Ukraine. His statement came hours after the leaders of Ukraine, Russia, Germany, and France announced a pullback of forces battling near the Russian border, an exchange of prisoners as part of that also, and a ceasefire set to begin on Sunday. Meantime, millions of civilians remain displaced because of all of this. They fled the violence, now living off charity, and despite the negotiations, few believe they will return home anytime soon. VOA's Daniel Scherf visited some of them in a monastery at a school in Severodvinsk.
Raisa Nechayeva and her granddaughter share a room with another family displaced by fighting in eastern Ukraine. Since July, they have lived at the Holy Mountains Lavra and Cave Monastery in Svetohirsk, which now houses 700 displaced people. The Lavra is a godsend for families like Nechayeva's, whose apartment and hometown of Horlivka continue to be devastated by shelling.
I live in a high-story building. My son stayed there. He's not going anywhere. All the windows are broken, the balcony is destroyed, and when we call him, he says he is shaking and sitting in the bathroom.
Despite the beautiful and secure surroundings, the situation is taking a toll on the family.
My granddaughter was caught in the shelling, so my daughter sent them away with me. My daughter is here now. She is working as a cleaner in a cafe in town. She is an engineer with two diplomas, but working as a cleaner just to earn some pennies for the children. You know, just to buy them some milk and candies.
Winter jackets are given to displaced children at a school in Svetohirsk. More than half of the school's nearly 500 students escaped from areas where Ukrainian forces are fighting Russia-backed rebels. Vice Principal Olga Valuch says teachers are working in two shifts to accommodate them all.
We teachers do our best so kids will feel comfortable close to our school and would not feel themselves as refugees. We really do not like the word refugee or internally displaced person. We just want these kids to be ours.
Valu says they have received donations from a wide variety of organizations, including the Holy Mountains Lavra, Russia-leaning politicians, and the Ukrainian military. But she says the support is not enough for families without homes.
People don't have unlimited amounts of money. It's really expensive to rent an apartment. Nobody can live for free. So we just pray to God that everything will end and people can return to their homes, their work, and their studies.
However, this mother of three, who fled the rebel-held city of Donetsk, says she has little hope a new ceasefire agreed in Minsk will allow her family to return home.
When they are gathering, they are discussing peace and a peaceful agreement. But then they are using force and everything starts all over again, even worse.
The ceasefire, to come into effect Sunday, is similar to a September deal that neither side fully honored. That leaves many civilians here, already a million displaced, feeling like they are caught up in a bigger and dangerous political game. Daniel Sheriff, VOA News, Svetohirsk, Ukraine.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Award-winning American TV news correspondent Bob Simon, who covered many of the world's major conflicts for a five-decade career, was killed on Wednesday night. Happened in a car crash in New York City. He was 73. Simon, who joined CBS News in 1967, began his time as a war correspondent back in 1971. That's when he was sent to Saigon at the height of the Vietnam War. Simon went on to serve 20 years as CBS's Middle East correspondent and was captured by Iraqi forces at the start of the Persian Gulf War in January of 1991. He spent 40 days in captivity. Later became a regular correspondent for the network news' magazine show 60 Minutes. Simon won numerous prestigious journalism awards during his career, including 27 Emmys. This week, the U.S. television network NBC suspended Brian Williams. He was one of their top news anchors and managing editor of the nightly news program. All of this came about because he had exaggerated his role covering the Iraq War in 2003. Williams gave differing accounts of a story involving a U.S. military helicopter that was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. Williams himself claimed he misremembered his word, the incident, by combining it in his mind with other factual memories. Experts agree that the psychological mechanisms that produce what we remember as the truth are part of a complex, highly fallible process which can have important consequences. VOA's Adam Phillips has our report.
University of Illinois psychology professor Daniel Simons is an expert on the psychology of memory and perception and how they can go awry. The co-author of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us, says that one of the most interesting things about us is how we assume we know our own minds.
And we often are wrong. We assume that when we remember something that's really vivid, really emotional, really detailed, that we must be remembering it accurately, that the way we remember it is the way it actually happened. But the reality is that our memories are not like a DVD that you play back in perfect fidelity every single time. Our memories are more like an improvisation. Each time we tell a story, we're reconstructing what happened. And when we reconstruct things, our memories can change. They can alter, they can shift, they can introduce things that didn't happen, and things that did happen can kind of fade away.
Simon says this is because the main purpose of memory may not be to recall things exactly, but to use our past experiences to make sense of new things that happen and to help us predict what may happen in the future. The actual source of a memory is often forgotten or distorted.
So memory is, in a lot of ways, like telling a story. And, of course, when we're telling a story about ourselves, we become the central actor in the story, and we become more and more central to the event. We've all had this experience. Maybe you have this great joke that you're telling to somebody, only to realize that the person you're telling to is the one who told it to you. Or maybe you have a childhood memory of, say, getting your hand slammed in a car door, only to realize that it actually happened to your sister or your brother. We have these sorts of memory failures all the time.
To test his assertion, Simon suggests this simple experiment.
If you have a really emotional memory, something that is really important to you, try writing out everything that you experienced in detail. And if other people were there with you at the time, email or write them and have them do the same thing, but don't tell them what you remember. And you'll likely find some pretty big discrepancies.
Today, well-known people like Brian Williams have copious records on the internet and other media that make their assertions about what happened to them in public relatively easy to verify or challenge. But most people may have only their own memories to rely on. This can have far-reaching consequences. Simon cites a recent National Academy of Sciences report that bears this out. Along with prosecutors, police, defense attorneys, judges, prisoner advocates, and other psychologists, he was part of a panel that examined cases where crime suspects were misidentified in police lineups or wrongly convicted based on eyewitness testimonies. The report also recommended ways to prevent those mistakes.
And the reason they had to do that is that there's now 40 years of research showing that memories for things we've seen can change. We can become more confident in our memories even when we shouldn't. We can introduce details that weren't there. We can recognize the wrong person and become more and more certain that the wrong person is the one we saw.
All this is why Simons would not expect Williams' memory to be flawless regarding what happened in his helicopter over Iraq that day in 2003. But he says there is a second point to consider.
Journalists know that if you have an unreliable or questionable source, you need to find other sources to corroborate the evidence to make sure that it's right. And memory is an unreliable source. It's hard to imagine that we're remembering things that just aren't true. But once you know that that happens, journalists, in a sense, have a responsibility to do that.
Daniel Simons is a psychology professor at the University of Illinois, specializing in memory and perception. He is also co-author with Christopher Chabris of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And many thanks to you, Adam. Now we turn to the world of sports, where Tiger Woods says his golf game is simply not acceptable right now for the professional circuit, and that he will not return until it is. That's right, he's dropped out of pro golf for a while. Woods shot a career worst 82 to miss the cut in the Phoenix Open. That was by 12 shots. He was playing poorly last weekend at Torrey Pines when he withdrew after 11 holes because of tightness in his back. 39-year-old Woods is currently number 62 in world rankings, the lowest since he turned professional in 1996. Woods has won 14 major golf tournaments, second all-time behind the golf great Jack Nicklaus. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. And if you find yourself on the internet looking at the news, talking about the news, you can find me there also on Twitter at VOA Norman. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers out at Abu Zed, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On February 13, 1689, the British Parliament presented the English Bill of Rights to the future King and Queen, William and Mary, the Prince and Princess of Orange. They accepted the document that not only limited royal power, but gave Parliament the right to tax. It remains one of the basic documents of English constitutional law. In 1777, the notorious French aristocrat, politician, philosopher, and writer, the Marquis de Sade, was arrested and imprisoned without charge in the Vincennes Fortress. De Sade was famous for his unrestrained sexual practices, which got him into trouble with the law. The words sadism and sadist are derived from his name. On this day in 1668, Spain recognized Portugal as an independent nation. In 1866, a notorious gang that included Jesse James and Cole Younger committed their first bank robbery in Liberty, Missouri. In 1883, the noted German composer Richard Wagner died of a heart attack. In 1923, retired U.S. Air Force general and renowned test pilot Chuck Yeager was born. Yeager was a key figure in the best-selling 1979 book and 1983 movie entitled The Right Stuff. In 1931, New Delhi became the capital of India. In 1935, a jury in Flemington, New Jersey, found Bruno Hauptmann guilty of the 1932 kidnapping and murder of the Lindbergh baby, the son of famous aviator Charles Lindbergh. Hauptmann was later executed for the crime. In 1960, France exploded its first atomic bomb. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History. Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including The Voice of America. Most recently, he has claimed credit for the kidnapping of more than 200 young girls from a school in Chibok and is threatening to sell them. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is also known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Skikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shiku. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the RFJ tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.